Hello and welcome to a post-match reaction to the Waratahs versus the Rebels. And I've just realised I forgot to send out the tweets. Let everyone know. I mean, who's going to join us if I don't tell them, hey? So, anyway, the Waratahs came back from being 10-20 down at halftime to win this convincingly 51-27. And hi, I'm Paul, the guy behind Driving Mall, a podcast, a YouTube channel, a Twitter account, and a website bringing you the best in rugby opinion and predictions. And joining me to chew over that game, I have the regular man from the Blues up in Auckland, Ashwin Hayding, sir.
Hello, everybody. Yes. I don't know, sorry, it's just breaking up a bit today for some reason. I'm not sure why. But, hello. And, interesting game. But obviously, we'll go over all the machinations of what transpired very shortly.
We will. And our man on the ground in Sydney, we have Hugh, who is a TAR supporter. So how are you doing, sir?
Very well. Thanks for having me back again. In a slightly better mood than last week.
That's very true. Hugh, join me for the Jaguares versus the Waratahs the last weekend. And obviously, yes, a much better result this weekend. But before we get on to the result, we really have to talk about the weather, because you were going to be at the game, but obviously conditions played a part in that.
Yep, for those who don't know, it's been 38 degrees today in Sydney, very hot, very windy as well. So conditions not great for watching or playing rugby, unfortunately, but obviously the TAR's able to get the job done today.
So is this normal weather, or is this kind of something that's a bit strange for this time of year?
No, it's a bit strange for this time of year. Not that we don't occasionally get the hot weather in March, but it's probably a little bit late in the season for this kind of weather.
Oh, okay, so we can't blame the authorities for bad scheduling then, and saying that they should be playing after dark when it cooled down a bit. Never mind. And that obviously played a part in today, because we had, I can't remember doing this before, but hearing the siren go off at 20 minutes, kind of a bit of a confusion, and Everyone stopping for a water break.
So apparently they enacted their extreme weather policy, which dictated that there were going to be drinks breaks every 20 minutes. It was the same also in the women's game with the New South Wales women against the Force women, which that kicked off at 1 o'clock local time. So obviously right in the middle of the day and the hot weather then.
Well, are you going to give us an update on the women's score?
I actually can't remember the final score, but New South Wales did win. So it was a good day for New South Wales.
Fabulous. So they won two out of those ones. So we do try and cover women's rugby a little bit occasionally, to take note of it. So, initially, I mean, the first thing, obviously, we're going to talk about is the colour of the jerseys. And listening to the ref, and he goes, advantage blue early on. And I'm like, well, who's that then? Because we had the light blue jerseys of New South Wales versus the dark blue jerseys of Melbourne or Victoria. Is that Victoria? I think so. Anyway.
Yes.
The referee then decided that the Rebels were actually in red. So I think he's colourblind. But apart from that, he had to come up with some way to distinguish them. But
red piping.
Pardon?
Red piping.
Red piping. Yes, exactly. They had red piping. So
maybe they need to borrow those Brazil soccer jerseys from the Bulls.
Oh, yes. You were listening the other night. The
Too bad.
Oh dear, I'll show you. Your link's not great. But one of the topics we will be talking about on Hash Rugby Chat on Tuesday night will be jerseys and clashes. Because tonight it was, whilst it was fine for watching, it wasn't fine for listening to the ref. And the Stormers versus the Blues was an absolute farce, really. But in this game starting out as a bit of a farce as well. We had a comedy of errors for the opening try. Who wants to take us through that?
To be fair, I actually thought that the Rebels were a bit unlucky that they wouldn't have scored. So it's sort of like the right result almost that came out. But yeah, Folau seems to take the ball quite nicely. Ball pass to him, passes it back to Kirtley Beale, who just basically shells it and straight into a Rebels arms, and just has to fall over the line to score, basically. So yeah, it was rather a strange thing, and you had to sort of see it again on replay to actually understand what happened.
And for me, so the top, the that was after 4 minutes. The Rebels got the early score. Kicking wasn't Hodges' strong point today, and he missed that one. So yeah, that was that's intercept by Flower. Beale then shells it. And I thought for that opening quarter of an hour, maybe even 20 minutes, both the sides were just trying crazy offloads and passes that were never on. And it just meant that we were having turnover after turnover after turnover. It wasn't pretty rugby.
No, not at all. Look, after 12 minutes, I think there'd been 12 turnovers up to that point, and it was pretty even from both sides with those turnovers. But, I mean, the story for the first probably 30 minutes, especially from the Tars, was that, they just kept pushing passes and making silly mistakes, and the Rebels capitalised on it, and that Tom English try was a perfect example of it.
And interestingly enough, it's just like it went to the 30-minute mark in that first half, but both teams pushing passes, the Rebels' passes coming off, the Waratahs' passes not, and it just looked like the Rebels were really on their game until that 38th-minute mark.
It did, and it looked like it was going to be a very similar story to last week with the Waratahs and the Jaguares, where the Tars were just shell-shocked and had no way of coming back.
Yeah, it was. I mean, we had some brain explosions. I mean, from the kickoff, when the Rebels got 3 points, Naffy drops the ball and Genia picks it up in front of him, thinking, "Oh well, it's a knock on, it's a scrum," and of course, then he's offside, so it becomes a penalty. Now they got lucky. I mean, in that situation, I think it's just been a scrum. It was clearly he was just picking up because, hey, it's scrum time now. But there really were some brain explosions by a lot of players going on during this game.
Yeah, like Rob Simmons being caught in front of the kicker off the kickoff. How often do you see that happen?
Actually, a couple of times this season. The refs clearly have picked up on that one. That's one they've been told to pick up on and keep an eye out for. So we have seen a couple of those this season. Clearly I watch too much rugby. But the that's one of the ones that refs have been told to pick up on. Again, another needless penalty. And you're thinking, what? Come on, guys. You're supposed to be professionals. Concentrate on the game.
So he saw that he was in front of the kicker. He'd taken, maybe 3 or 4 steps, realised he was in front, stopped running, put his hands up. Should the penalty still be blown or should it be play on? It had no impact on the play.
Yeah, good question. I mean, there are plenty of times where at the breakdown, the ref will go, two, hands off the ball now. And he'll take his hands off the ball and it's all okay. But actually, he was infringing at that point before he got told. So, yeah, good point, maybe. But those, I say it's one of the ones that the refs have been told to look at. And so, yeah, he's got caught and pinged for it.
Just on the on a scenario like that, with the kick through, you got the forwards progressing. Technically, I think they should go with the call and make the call that the players are progressing or they're offside, because at the end of the day, you've actually affected the return of the receiving team. And although we don't know what's going to transpire, they've taken space on the field, which could impede what the team would have done. So, actually, I'm in agreement. At the end of the day, the law is that they don't go forward until they're put onside, and we still see too many sides actually progressing. So, I'm actually in agreement with the referee calling those ones.
Yep. And in that first 38 minutes, a couple of players I thought were playing pretty well for the Rebels. Obviously, Maffey, who had that long-range 60-meter try, and also his back row partner, Tamani. I thought he was having a good game as well, disrupting things for the Tars. And then the Rebels do play a very narrow game plan. They don't seem to want to spread it. They know they've got a heavy pack, and they just don't want to use the width of the pitch, was how I felt a lot of that play was.
Yeah, and interestingly, the Tars forwards actually really stood up this week, which could well have had an impact on the result. Obviously, it was the backs in the second half who were the beneficiaries of that. But the TAR scrum was excellent. The line out was pretty good. They certainly competed well at the breakdown. And I thought they were quite successful in slowing down the Rebels' ball. So that affects the play of people like Genya and Murphy. And I think they got a little bit frustrated there, actually, late in the first half.
No, you can definitely see that. Another player, actually, who I've been, is De Bresini. Someone I don't rate, but I thought defensively he was pretty good tonight in that first half.
Yeah, I thought he was pretty good with the ball in hand too, actually. Today he showed a couple of nice touches. Interestingly, on Murphy, who is probably one of the best players in Australian rugby, but of course plays international rugby for Japan, word came out during the week that the Rugby Australia is looking at either reducing or eliminating the number of international players playing for Australian Super Rugby sides.
Yep, no, I saw that. And part of the rationale behind that is if you've got to have enough players to play international, and if you've got 14 rather than 5, you can't afford to have too many foreigners in there, or foreign eligible players in there. But I think, yeah, I think there'll still be places for players like him. I think that what they need to do is look at the Irish model, where in Ireland, there's only allowed to be one foreign player per position between the four franchises. So if one of the teams has got an import at scrum half, the other three teams aren't allowed to have an import in that position. And maybe something on those lines might work for work in Australia.
Makes a lot of sense.
But okay, onto the stats, because I love my stats, to show you how narrow the Rebels play. Genya passed the ball 41 times in this game. No one else on the Rebels side passed more than 7 times, which was De Bresini. Everyone else only passed the ball a maximum of 3 times, which just shows you that it really was one out rugby for the Rebels for the vast majority of this game, with the very occasional wide play, and that really they really got found out from doing that in that second half.
Yeah, I actually felt that Genya really was off colour in the game, even when the Rebels were going through their purple patch. We've talked about Genya actually coming in at first five, as well as halfback, but he just seemed to be shoveling the ball out today. I don't know whether, as you said, 41 times that Genya has passed the ball, whether that was part of the Rebels' game plan, is just to move from ruck to ruck, just didn't really see the spark that we normally see from Morgenia.
Yeah, no, I think maybe the game plan was the Waratahs were just flown back from Argentina. Let's just tire them out. We'll go through the phases and they'll lose. And that really didn't work. Again, turning point in this game was that try just before halftime for the TARS. And again, another one of these comedy of errors. Or lucky events. The TARS weren't really going anywhere at that point. Try and put a grubber through. It gets blocked. A bit of confusion. Kirtley Beale picks it up and just runs through a gap because everyone's looking where the ball is. And hey presto, it's only try time. If that ball hadn't been blocked, this grubber would have gone out and I think the opportunity would have gone.
What did you guys think of the Beale pass to Fitzpatrick, who was the person that it then passed it to Fekete? I thought it was marginal.
I believe that the sit on the fence commentator term for that is it was a lateral pass rather than backwards.
Backwards out of the hands.
Yeah, floated forward. Yeah, nice pass for a hooker anyway.
No, I'd look. I mean, and I suppose through a lot of phases of play throughout the game, you'll get passes like that, and it's just like it's line ball and it's hard to call. And you're going to get those ones going through, and you'll get good with bad, I suppose. So you take them when you get them.
Yeah, absolutely. And let's be honest, as long as you don't throw it too far forwards, you get away with it nowadays, and you have done for many years. So yeah, lateral passes. Yeah, I'm all this stuff of coming back without the hand. I'm fine. If you're running that fast forwards, pass it back further, so it has to actually go backwards. That's how I would like to see the interpretation or the actual rule. that the ball, yes, the ball has to go backwards. If you're running fast, throw it further behind you. Would be right. But unfortunately, that's not, they've all this physics business just gets in the way
of momentum.
So,
yeah, but that try was lucky. Is basically, as you said, bit of pinball. Fagetti puts the kick through that really doesn't go through, and just pinballs into, was it Fitzpatrick's hands or was it Beal's hands? I can't remember which way around it was.
Beal's hands.
And was the catalyst for the Waratahs basically to get back in the game and not look back.
So then, obviously, the Tars won the second half. Well, I forgot what the score was now. 41-7. It just turned totally around. The great coaching by Daryl Gibson, or awful coaching by Vessels.
Look, a lot of people rate Vessels very highly. Actually, I'm not sure it was horrible coaching by him. It was pleasing to see the Tars adopt a far different attitude in attack this week. Obviously, selecting Folau on the wing and Hegarty at fullback gave plenty of options for first receiver. So Hegarty was up at first receiver, Beal was up at first receiver. Obviously, the crossfield kicks were used probably five or six times to Folau. The first couple of times, not so successfully, but after that, very successfully. Some pick and goes. There was that variety that was so lacking last week.
Yeah, I was just going to say, and just on the Folau point, you know, with when he got his game together and he started catching everything in the air, the Rebels just didn't know how to approach it. It's like he's taking everything. Well, do we compete in the air? Do we just wait for him to hit the ground and take him out? And nothing was working when the ball was in the air for Folau to catch.
Yeah, I was going to say, I think actually the Tars became one-dimensional in that first half of the second half. Just that dimension was working extremely well, which was kick it high, let Folau either catch the ball or tackle the guy straight away so that our guys can get in and turn the ball over, and then we'll break from there. That became basically the game plan was Foley or Beal. Boot it up, let Folau compete for it, and that's our entire game plan for the second half. And it won, basically. I don't see that mixed game plan that you were talking about.
Yeah, look, I just thought that it was a change from last week where they kept throwing it wide. I thought that there were some pick and goes. There were a few forward hit-ups off nine. Obviously, they did use that kick, and if it's working, why not?
Oh, absolutely. No, I totally agree with you. If it's working, why not? As Oscar says, basically, I think that the loss of Dame Hale at Pessy came into the fore at that point. You've lost your fullback. You've lost a Wallaby fullback, effectively, and you've put someone who's played a lot at wing, a lot at centre, at fullback. And yes, he can generally do a good job back there, can Hodge, but against Folau, who's probably the best player in rugby at the moment at taking the high ball, then you've got to say that he was on a loser basically. And they needed to have two players back there the whole time, one to contest the ball, the other one to tackle Folau as soon as he got it if they failed. And you don't have enough players on the pitch to do that. And then basically so that was basically it for me. Folau basically won the aerial battle, and that's how they got three tries. And then after that, they actually got some confidence. And instead of the four players playing together, which is Foley, Folau, Beal, and Hooper, and ignoring everyone else, they actually started to include the other players, and therefore the other players started to get confidence, and they scored a bunch more.
You want to chuck the ball to Naio Ravoro, don't you? He seems to be able to get them going forward quite well and bump off players as well. He had quite a bit of impact when he came on.
He sure did, just especially that second try, too big, too strong.
Six runs for 92 metres, and what was he on for? He was on for the last 15 minutes?
Yeah, I was going to say 15, 20 minutes. That's a phenomenal sort of impact player, as they say.
But he is a guy that, yeah, if he's against tired players, and we saw there were definitely tired players out there, the temperature didn't help that at all. We saw that some late hits, some players just too tired to pull out.
I was going to say, the weather conditions seem to impact the Rebels considerably more than the New South Wales players. Would that be a fair comment, you think? I'm not sure. I mean, both the conditions are both same for the season, but it's the Rebels didn't handle these conditions well at all. They basically had no puff in that second half.
That was what it looked like. I suspected at the beginning of the game that it would have actually been the other way around with the travel the cars have done, but they regrouped. Gibson did come out early in the week and say that they were going to have a very light week to make sure that their recovery was effective for this week, and it looked like it worked. Lots of subs around that half-time mark, I guess, as well.
I think there was another other. Because we talked about Narivaro came on at the 50th minute, so he had half an hour to make 92 metres, but even so, that was still a big impact. A couple of things on this. Possession in that second half. The Waratahs had 67% of the possession. The Rebels had 33% of the possession. They spent a lot of time defending in that second half, which takes much more energy because you've all got to be awake, you've all got to be defending, attacking. You can take a breather and let other people do a bit of running for a little bit and step back into your position. You don't have to be on the ball so much. We see that again in tackles. New South Wales, 57 tackles the entire game. The Rebels, 110. So they made nearly twice as many tackles. They didn't see that ball in the second half. They had a dysfunctioning line out that really didn't help them maintain possession. And as you say, they ran out of steam because they were having to defend so much.
So question, one thing I'll never get my head around is, so you've got the Rebels, you know, you're watching the game, you're sort of thinking they're not getting any ball, and they get the ball and they kick it away. At the end of the day, you know that you're not going to win the game if you kick the ball away, so you might as well try and hold on to it and try and do something with it. I don't know, that's just the thought that I had running through my head while I was watching that second half.
Well, the Waratahs was kicking the ball away very well and getting it back again.
They were kicking and competing.
They were kicking and competing. The Rebels' kicking was nowhere near as good. It was either too long or too short. There were some up and unders that went 5 meters, which was just appalling. You're right. The Rebels' kicking game was off today.
And when you look at the first half, it's just like where they made the yards was with the interplacing. With the inside channels and that sort of thing, or off, you know, pop-up balls and that sort of thing. So it just doesn't make any sense when something's not working with the kicking and they didn't go back to something that was working for them.
I think there's also an element of they wanted to play in the right part of the pitch, which we hear quite a lot at the moment. They obviously didn't feel they could score from a long way out, which is a bit silly, which I don't think I agree with. When you got players... not so much English, but who were the other two?
Maddox
was doing well, and also Billy Meeks. Both of those players were happy to run from a long way out and make yards. In Maddox, 97 metres, okay, Meeks only 28, so perhaps not so much. And then you've also had Maffey, who scored from like the halfway line. They could score from a long way out, but they didn't.
Corabetti as well, but I don't think Corabetti saw much ball.
No, you're right.
Nope, Corabeshi hardly saw the ball at all. Four runs, 23 metres. So when he did get the ball, he didn't go very far.
It is effectively his first season in Super Rugby, though, isn't it? I mean, he really didn't get a lot of game time last year. I think he was injured, or there was something, or he didn't see a lot of game time.
Straight to the Wallabies, wasn't he?
You can say the same about Curtis Roan. I mean, Curtis Roan has hardly had is new to the sport as well.
He was very good today, I thought.
But he did very well today, as you say, with 84 meters. But then again, if you look at, again, we were talking about how the Rebels are so narrow. If we look at the Waratahs, their game plan: kick the ball, get possession back, spin it wide.
Go wide.
And you can see that because I talked about the fact that only Debussini had made 7 passes, and he was the second most passes for the Rebels. If you look at the Waratahs, obviously the short at scrum half, 60 passes. Foley 29, Kirtley Beale 21. So they were shifting it wide. And if we go through, Rona made 84 metres, Beale 52 metres, Fichetti 55 metres, Flau a bit less on 42 and Hegarty on 48. But you've got to remember, Flau probably ran about another 150 metres chasing kicks. So that's why he's not got the metres run with ball, is because he was where the breakdown was before they spread it wide. I guess is my point rather than... But yeah, they used their backs a lot, whereas the Rebels didn't so much. The number of carries by their forwards is much higher. I mean, and also for not very far. So Philip for the Melbourne Rebels, 7 carries for 17 metres. It was lots of bash, bash, bash in that first half. And again, you say in the second half, they only wanted to play another opposition half. And they just never got hold of the ball in that second half because they weren't prepared to play out of their own half, which is what they needed to do because they just weren't getting the ball.
But Hugh's not going to be complaining about it, are you?
I'm not complaining. And the Rebels have such good ball runners in their forwards. You know, as we talked about the back rowers, but Phillip and Coleman as well, are so good with the ball in hand, but we just didn't see enough of it.
Yep.
Yep. I think we've covered most of what we said. Yeah, the Rebels tired, great kick, and spreading it wide, and then Niavoro is obviously impact player. I'm still not convinced, though, by Ned Hennigan as a lock. And the weight in that pack, I don't think, is there. And I think Hennigan-Simmons isn't really a Super Rugby lock pairing.
It's not going to strike fear into many opposition teams, is it?
No. yeah, that's my point. So I think they need to sort that out. I don't think, whilst they got away with it this weekend, I think they're going to struggle against fitter, more mobile big packs.
Yeah, look, I was definitely impressed with the improvement in the scrum. I thought Kepu made a big difference up front with the scrum. And I mean, Simmons has got a lot of experience. I'm not sure if he was that good today. It looked a bit rusty, but hopefully he'll improve, and they've got a week off next week. So rest up for the Brumbies in 2 weeks' time.
I think at the end of the day, if the back line can perform as well as it did today in the second half, then as long as the forwards can provide any semblance of quality ball, that's what their job will be. They don't have to dominate up front, but as long as the back line can make the right calls, get that go forward with Israel Folau with the high ball, and as soon as he catches, you know, because he's catching that ball consistently, and it goes off. I mean, and if he takes it cleanly, it gets out quick. The backs are there to be able to take advantage of it. And if they can do that, then you don't necessarily have to have that big dominating pack unless it gets muddy. But how many muddy fields do we see these days?
That's another point. That pitch was cutting up something chronic early on. That I don't understand the sandy-based pitches that we see in Australia. They just seem to cut up too much. Anyway.
Doesn't it make for better drainage? Isn't that why they do it?
No, but the thing is that over here in New Zealand, they've moved away from the sanded fields. I don't understand the structure that they use now, but I know that the sand-based systems are sort of old hat. But the other thing is that I think reality is that, I suppose with rugby down the pecking order, groundsmen are probably making a super hard and fast field for the other sports that play on those fields. And it's not conducive to scrums going down and packing down and putting that pressure on the playing surface.
The True, Sydney Football Stadium sees a huge amount of use. It's also home to the Sydney Roosters in the NRL and Sydney FC in the A-League. So it is used a lot.
And Shard NZ in the live chat goes, the pigeons liked it. And yes, there was definitely one moment. Actually, the time that that Mathy knocked it on and Genia picked it up. He was surrounded by pigeons. And I'm like, no wonder he couldn't see the ball and catch it. There was just too many other things moving around for him to try and his radar could only lock onto one. got Max mixed up.
So, what's the story with the pigeons there?
I don't know, mate. They must have got lost and come over from the SCG next door because there was no cricket on.
Okay, at least it was being played on a rectangle pitch, not on an oval. But as you say, we've seen similar problems in the AMI. I think it's AMI Stadium in Melbourne,
yeah,
where you've got the Melbourne Storm. There's whatever the Melbourne Football Club is that's down there.
Melbourne Victory.
Oh, there we go. And also the Melbourne Rebels all play on the same pitch. And again, they've had problems down there with that pitch cutting up and having a similarly with that sand base. So hopefully it's something they can get sorted, because just from a player welfare point of view, really.
Agreed.
I think I've covered most of what I was going to say. Hugh, congratulations on the win. Any kind of final points?
I'm just interested in your take, or in both of your take, on the Rebels now. Where do they sit? They had three bonus point wins up until today. They've now lost to the Waratahs. They have to play the Sharks and the Hurricanes in the next 2 weeks. How do you think they'll go?
I think they'll pick it up against the Sharks, because they've got Sharks next week. The Haylett Petty's the big concern for them, obviously, because we assume, for player welfare sakes, that he won't be there for at least a week, if not two or three. That was a big knock. So I think that'll be the big concern with Haylett Petty. But I think they'll go back and saying, hey, look, what was working for us and why did we go away from it? Because that's the trend of what we've had our discussion about. And if they analyze that and go back to what was working for them, I think they should turn the Sharks over. But hey, I don't know why Paul has me on the show, because this week's been a horror for me with my predictions.
No, I agree. I think against the Sharks, I'll be fine. Against the Hurricanes, I think they'll get whooped, to be honest. But I do feel that this was their first decent game. There are other games they've played. The Reds at home, where they had a player red carded and a yellow card as well. So they had to win that game. Away to the Sunwolves, who until this weekend have been abysmal. And then home to the Brumbies, who again had been poor up until then, and also they basically won that game on yellow cards. They defended better on their yellow card and didn't concede any points, or I think maybe conceded one try, and then they scored three tries against the Brumbies when the Brumbies were down to 14 men. So it seems if you can keep 15 men on the pitch against the Rebels, they'll struggle. If you lose a player, they seem to have got some systems that really work when you're down a player. So against the Sharks, I think they'll be fine, but I think against Hurricanes, they'll struggle.
Right. So quickly, my next question. I'm assuming that was probably the two best Australian teams this afternoon. Will an Australian team beat a New Zealand team this year?
Yes.
The Blues?
Yeah. Shut up. Well, it depends which one turns up.
Well, we'll talk about it tomorrow night, but as far as I'm concerned, I think the same Blues turned up just on the last two weekends. Just one weekend the passes stuck and the other weekend they didn't, basically. But, again, the Blues are clearly going to be the most likely team to beat them. I wouldn't discount the Reds yet. I think the Reds, when you say the best two teams, I think the Reds could come good. Because I say they lost that first game, was on cards more than anything else, and they've looked a bit more backbone since then. So I think the Reds may come good. So don't discount them in the battle of all this. And I just can't believe the Brumbies are going to stay this bad, to be honest. So I think it could be quite a competitive conference this year.
Which is good.
It is good. Actually, scheduling is the other one I was going to talk about. The Hurricanes fly back from Jaguares and have to face the next weekend the Crusaders, the best team in the conference, and then get a week off. The Waratahs fly back from the Jaguares have to play the Rebels, the best team, supposedly, in the conference, and then get a week off. It just seems strange to me that you, after the longest flight you do, you have to play a game and then you get a week off. Why not have that week off the week before? Is that just too simple?
For many years now, I've looked at the scheduling of the Super Rugby competition, and you just shake your head and you sort of think, surely it doesn't take a rocket surgeon to work out a better schedule, especially for the teams travelling back. I mean, although the Stormers did end up tipping their Blues over, it's the same for them going travelling all the way back there to play the game. It's logic. You go, you play your games, and you get a week off when you get back. As I said, you don't need to be a rocket surgeon, I'm sure, to work out a matrix that will take that into consideration.
Quick comment there. That I think that even though the Hurricanes and the Waratahs flew back and then won, and the Stormers flew back and won.
you make lies of us.
it makes the stats and everything. Obviously, this, as they say, stats and damn lies. Which goes against common sense as to what should happen in those situations. But it does seem to me like they should have rest again from the player.
It would just make it a level playing field if they did it that way. Is that everybody knows that as soon as they return from their longest trip, they get a week off.
Yep, totally agreed.
Yep, I agree too.
That's a bit boring, especially an opinion show. So it's a disagreement.
Yeah, they're like, no, you're all wrong.
Hugh, any more points?
No, that's it from me. Thanks for having me on again.
Ashwin?
I'd just like to say it wasn't a game of two halves. It was a game of 38 minutes and 42 minutes.
It wasn't a game of two halves. It was a game of four quarters because we had the 20-minute pieces as well.
At the end of 16 overs, let's have drinks.
Oh, dear me. It has been a pleasure again. Thank you very much, guys. Hugh, why don't you let people know where they can get in touch with you during the week and have a good old yarn about rugby?
Yep, on Twitter, and my handle is HEF0909.
And Ashwin, where can people hear about New Zealand politics and rugby?
Well, it has been an interesting day in New Zealand politics, but you know the story there. NZ Fatso on Twitter. And I saw the 0909 on Hughes. I thought he's an Aucklander. It's our area code.
Oh, dear me. Well, we have four digit postcodes, so should have been able to figure out where his house was. I've been Paul, the guy behind Driving Mall. Thank you very much for joining us yet again. Podcast, YouTube channel, all that kind of stuff. Please don't forget to subscribe to the YouTube channel if you're watching. Face there or the red button down below. Obviously, latest videos up there. And obviously, subscribe to the podcast if you're listening through your favorite podcasting app. 5-star review, because there are other stars, but why would you want to? And enjoy whatever rugby you're watching.